Welcome to Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. On today's podcast, we are going to nerd out on all things Bitwise Fallout with two local attorneys. We have Jesse Molina, who is an adjunct professor at the San Joaquin College of Law, and he's also the founder and attorney at Valley Business and Tech Law. Welcome to the podcast, Jesse.
Thank you.
And we also have Vince Tenorelli. Vince is a former U.S. attorney. He's also an adjunct professor at the San Joaquin College of Law and an associate general counsel at Community Health. Glad to have you here.
Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Before I begin, being a lawyer, I have to clarify that the opinions I'm going to express are my own and not those of anybody else, including my employer.
We thought that we'd start this podcast in kind of a fun place because it's going to be a little bit of a dark show covering the demise of a company that was important to the area and our economy. And I wanted to ask you both, which Shakespeare play does the Bitwise tragedy remind you of most? It reminds me of Macbeth. You have a king and a queen. You've got blood on your hands. You've got some well-intended people maybe pursuing an end that would end in their demise. Typical tragedy.
And my daughter just saw Macbeth for the first time last week.
Yeah. Do you think that tracks? Do you see it as a tragedy of Shakespearean proportions or not?
Oh, I definitely do.
Okay.
No, I think it was a travesty and a betrayal.
I do, although I guess my caveat is I think from the beginning it was looking, it wasn't like it was something that was ever really successful and then just fell to a tragic end. I think it was always predestined that something like this was going to happen from the beginning.
So it's somewhere like between a farce and a tragedy. It's a little bit of a comedy.
I think that's fair.
And that's a good segue to a question that we've been wanting to ask, which is hindsight's always 20/20. Everyone after Bitwise went down was like, oh, I saw this coming. But then there were some actual red flags in the beginning that were signs for at least some people. I certainly had my own, that this was maybe not entirely what it was supposed to be or seemed to be. What were some of your early red flags, Jesse?
For me, the very first one was, I think it was around 2016. There was a press release that was issued when Irma Olguin was appointed to a board. And on that press release, it showboated the success of all these tech companies as if it were Bitwise's success. And essentially, it was their tenants. It wasn't an actual company. It wasn't an actual platform that was successful. It'd be just like this awesome place we're here, Sun Stereo. We all know the great owner here. Taking credit for the tenant's revenue as if it were his own. And that was the very first big red flag, that this is not only misleading, but especially in a sector where it's about revenue growth, it was completely like almost designed to make it as if it were something that's not.
Vince, how about you? Did you have any things that you saw about Bitwise that stood out to you early on?
I think for me, it was just always one of those companies where it was, what do they do exactly? And how are they continuing to buy all these buildings?
What's their product, if you will?
Yeah. And Jesse knows more about this than I do, but I would think that for a company like that, what you really would expect to see for a company growing like that is some IP that is actually valuable in making money. And I don't think they ever had any that they could show.
They didn't have a platform or a product. And when you looked at the main three things they'd always point to, which is education, that's an expense. That's not something that has margins and it's scalable, that you can get adopters and users overnight. And you always have to throw money at these problems. And the other main component was when it came to some tech services they provided, that also is an area that you can lose money in the sense that you're constantly trying to customize or bid or have proposals, and you could, with the labor and overshooting the project, you can lose money on those things. So I didn't see anything that was ever scalable that was a revenue generator. If anything, the education portion was a great mission, a great thing that I believed in and supported, but it didn't seem like it was something that could generate revenue or anything of that sort.
Yeah, I think there's that memoir fallacy where someone ends up bad, you have a dictator, and then you go searching through their childhood to find some terrible incident, some rosebud incident that led them to be who they are. And how much do you think hindsight plays into your perspective, Jesse?
With regard to what?
With regard to Bitwise, the outcome. Would you look at it differently if they hadn't? Because there's a lot of companies that have been burning through cash that still exist.
Yeah.
And are still operating that maybe don't have clear products. Like, how does hindsight play in your perspective?
Let me try to answer it this way, and please feel free to push back if it's not a direct answer, because I'm not trying to elude it. Because the thing is, there was major concern from the very beginning, where you had people coming in education-wise, then they were getting exposed to programming. Great, wonderful. And as somebody that was in the tech sector, I was general counsel for a tech company that was hiring some of the folks who are coming out of that, their academy, they weren't employable. A lot of them were major risks, and there were issues there in and of itself. Then when it came down to...
I want to second you on that, because I talked to someone that worked at a local tech company that said they hired contractors from Bitwise and then had to hire a new set of remote contractors to fix whatever happened from Bitwise contractors. Yeah. So I have heard this as well.
Yeah, so that was a major issue. It was always very difficult to... I wanted to believe in it. I wanted it to be successful. It was a great idea. And as it's been said many times recently, great idea for a nonprofit, but it was never a for-profit type of model from the onset, from what I saw. And that was always the biggest concern.
Why don't you think that they made it a nonprofit in the beginning? That never made sense to me.
Yeah, I'm not too sure. I don't know. Now, this is where my bias from working in the private equity world comes in, and when it's about acquiring businesses, creating a narrative, showing an upward trend. And when you're looking to make an exit, when you want to have generational wealth, you want to have money that's going to change your life as a founder, this is what you do. You create a for-profit, this is the law that I teach in. You create a corporation, you have a vehicle, an instrument for investment, you scale it, and the idea is in 3, 5, 7 years, I'm going to sell this at 30, 40, 50 times what I put into it and get rich. It's just the same story.
Yeah. But the thing that they were pitching, at least in the beginning, was they're not trying to grow Bitwise. They're trying to grow Fresno. Fresno was the product in some ways.
Yeah.
Downtown was the product.
That was. But then when they had some success, visibility to the area, great. Bringing some awareness and some life and excitement to downtown to work in. But it wasn't as if they were creating jobs. They were creating employees. They're creating a workforce where nowhere to put them. And that was their whole pipeline idea. Right. But then soon after, they never achieved, or there was no mission accomplished. There wasn't some type of big moment. All of a sudden, they're moving. They started going into I think it was Ohio.
How much do you think that investment capital that they got pushed them to move outside of California?
My guess.
You could only create so many jobs here, right?
Yeah.
Or have so many worker bees running around Fresno.
Yeah, and the tech community wasn't as if there was some huge gains in tech jobs, from my vantage point. And then you see the movement and going in. I think it was required by the funding. Okay, you're going to have this pitch to investors in a time and an era where you have the founders and their background and their makeup, which was a very compelling and interesting story. And you had folks who were looking to fund those types of great stories. And in order to have, you want to expand your reach, you want to reach more people when it comes to rural areas, education, social mobility, all wonderful stuff that we believe in. But there wasn't as if they accomplished what they need to accomplish here, and then they started to expand. So what that did for me was, okay, this is what a lot of private equity firms do. They invest, they're not making the numbers, they want to look like they're successful. They want to show it by we're expanding, we're growing, and they're going to get all these things, put them together, bolt them together, put a nice bow on it, and sell it. That was that was the first.
Okay, so let me ask you both this. What do you make of the city of Fresno local officials' response? A lot of it was, let's find jobs for these people, it's a tragedy, and then a lot of their rhetoric, their boosterism, disappeared almost immediately. What do you make of all that?
I don't know. I don't really know how much you can really do when something like this happens. I don't think that the city financially was, from what I've seen, all that tied up with Bitwise. I expected whenever it went down that it would turn out that there were a lot of arrangements. There really weren't. And then I really think that I don't really know how much the city could have done personally once this all kind of hit.
Yeah, I think they were pretty coy and smart when it came to using their corporate veil and identity to protect them and shield them, whether it comes from legal issues, but also just not opening up the books. The answer to everything was, we're private. We don't share these things. We don't talk about it. There was that, I think it was a $1 million contract, right? It was connected directly to the city, and the city didn't do their due diligence. But in the tech community, for folks who are looking to engage Bitwise, when it came to their services or development model, they were known to be a very pricey solution that was not always that their price did not always match their services, and had a difficult time meeting not only expectations but timelines. Being that I worked for a tech company that hired programmers and engineers, they had some great programmers and engineers. There's no doubt about that. We can say that there was great talent there and some people that had some amazing skill sets. However, the overall generalization, I think, was not accurate. But when there was a few former Bitwise employees that had come over to companies I worked for, talking with them, what they shared with me was, we were always on the cusp of failure. We had to get this contract. We had to get this, or we're about, we thought we were going to, the doors were going to close and we're going to go out of business. And this was years ago. This wasn't as has been portrayed in the media as all of a sudden this in May of 2023, it occurred, and who saw it coming? They had this upward trend and they were hiring and building out. That's what the media narrative was. That's what coincidentally was what Irma and Jake were selling. The media bought what they sold.
And that comes back to this other question we've talked about offline, Jesse, which is the role of the media narrative. And I know you have a lot of thoughts about that. I certainly do as a planner. I know that Bitwise used to communicate through these open letters to the community. Mm. In one of the open letters, they promised that they were going to create, I believe it was over 250,000 jobs in downtown Fresno in 5 years.
Well, my favorite was the train tracks.
The train to rural.
And at a third of the population of the city as
my
well.
My urban planning friends were just like, this is beyond ludicrous. Like, downtown San Francisco doesn't even have 100,000 jobs. So we're going to more than almost triple the amount of jobs that downtown San Francisco has in 5 years. It was not feasible. And so I'm just wondering, what are your thoughts about how we could have done a better job in the media to call out those things?
Yeah. When it comes to the investors and the media, it seems let's say you're buying a car, right? And you got to look under the hood, got to kick the tires. They're trying to sell you something that says, don't look under the hood, don't touch the tires. That's one level. But then here's a picture of the car. It's in perfect condition, and people were putting money and covering that picture of the car versus looking at it and doing their due diligence. It was a bit frustrating because there was, from my vantage point, because there were successful tech companies selling with local founders, selling their companies for millions of dollars, and the tens of millions of dollars, and bringing some awareness to investors and private equity across the country. I thought those folks should have gotten more acknowledgement for their work. But Bitwise was the media darling. And they were the ones that were courting the city council. The city council had took every opportunity to have photos with them. And there was always some type of great, wonderful article about the thing that they're doing and how they're changing the world.
James Fallow's book, that town book where yes. they're included in it. Yeah.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
And then, I don't know if you saw, but he has a blog, James Fallows does.
Okay. I haven't looked at that in a while, but yeah.
Yeah, I was really curious after all of this went down, what's he going to say to this? And he had a small acknowledgement. Yeah, things
a little asterisk.
Yeah. But I have to say, as much as Bitwise was a part of his narrative for Fresno, I am very happy to say, obviously, Bitwise is just one tiny little shred of our narrative.
That's it. Yeah. Let's talk about accountability. I'm going to transition us. So there's this kind of spectrum between a lack of due diligence on the investor's part and then misleading the investors on the Bitwise part. So how do you think about that spectrum, and we think about accountability in this situation?
I've read through what they call the criminal complaint, where the government detailed all the conduct here. And what's pretty clear from that is that you had two people that were keeping information pretty close to the vest, and that these investors, what was also surprising is that a lot of the money is being lost by a few people or entities. They're just called Investor 1, Investor 2, or Investor A and B, who invest at the beginning, and then I think it's what they call a sunk cost fallacy, where they're in for some, and then they don't maybe want to think that they made a mistake. And it's very compelling in those situations when they come back and say, I need a little more money. You don't want to think that you made an initial mistake, and you continue to fund it, chasing the idea that, you know, because it's very hard to come to terms with the fact that you may have been fooled once. And so these investors who were on the board, I think that they got in early, and as a result felt very invested in the company, and therefore they could keep going back to those investors for more funding and to support more funding later.
How does the legal world look at that accountability question maybe differently than the public, thinking about responsibility around due diligence versus misleading investors?
In terms of the criminal case, the primary focus for a case like this, a wire fraud case like this, is going to be about representations that are made, who's making them, and basically the representations to get money, because that was what the focus of the criminal case was. And those representations were all made by two people. And that's why you only see two people charged and two people prosecuted.
Is there ever times in cases like these where the board of directors gets held accountable as well? Or is it really whoever's doctoring the statements is the one who gets the punishment at the end of the day?
So here, in terms of the financial loss, and I understand that maybe the people that were on the board of directors are wealthy folks, although I don't know who they are, but they apparently had millions and millions of dollars to invest. They themselves lost a lot of money on this. And again, they were apparently shown false financial statements, false bank statements, and things like that. I don't think it would be very common where the board of directors isn't profiting from the fraud to see them held accountable in a criminal sense. You want to focus on who is receiving a financial gain from the fraud.
I would love to hear more about due diligence on the lender side. There's lots of different types of investors into Bitwise, and anyone from Goldman Sachs to like random small farmers that are just trying to get a better return on their retirement investments. What should they have done differently? And why, after so many times and very high profile cases, Bernie Madoff, crypto scandals, why don't we have better checks to protect people from these types of cases? Yep.
So there's the criminal side of things that makes a individual corporation accountable in the context of criminal conduct and jail time and whatnot. Then there's the law of corporations, where shareholders, board of directors, and officers are fiduciaries of the corporation, and there's certain requirements that you have to abide by to protect investors, to protect shareholders, to protect the corporation in and of itself. What's interesting is you can be a shareholder, you can be a board member, and you can be an officer like Jake and Irma were all at the same time. And what in corporation law we call that is an inside director. And you have to be very careful if you're an investor, if you're relying on financial statements and representations made by inside directors, meaning you're on the board of directors and you're supposed to oversee and manage the corporation, not the day-to-day operations like an officer, but you're also an officer, so you're inside and you have access to information that other board of, and the law recognizes that because you're in a unique position as an inside director, you can control what other board members see, what the information is. And so there is a mechanism to make those directors accountable. So Jake and Irma had all of the access to the financial records, had all access to audits and what they call a cap table, which is a breakdown of who owes how much and who owes when it comes to the shares. So what they did is they had that information and they presented it to the board. The board can rely on those representations. They have no ability or little ability, unless they were to do an internal audit on their own, to see what it is. These pitch decks, or these, actually they're board decks where they're presenting on a quarterly basis, the board is supposed to serve in that function to say, okay, are we in a good financial health? Yes, and we have good reports, and there should have been independent accounting agencies that are performing and conducting are creating the financial statements. It seems like a lot of stuff was done internally. And so you can cook the books, you can make it look however you want to. But when it comes to your ultimate question, which is due diligence from investors, whether it be banks or whatnot, they had sophisticated investors that, I'm sure, especially when I reviewed kind of the documentation, these investors have major law firms that are doing exactly that. They're looking at every little thing. There's a purchase agreement that has representations and warranties. And so they had to go in and make dozens of statements of saying this is accurate, this is what it is, and under making sure that if there's any breach of this contract that they would be penalized and paid. These investors, I'm sure, thought they did their due diligence and had law firms and paid lots of money to ensure that it was what they said, But at the end of the day, you have an issue of a forgery. If you're forging documents and you're relying on those documents, that's where they got you.
Yeah, I agree. I think that it wasn't so much for the doctored financial statements are one thing, but to think that someone is going to forge a bank statement and change the numbers on it, I think it takes a lot to get there. You have to really suspect someone of being a really bad faith actor to think they're going to do that. And that's what happened here. And I think in that, in those situations, it's really hard to take your mind there to think somebody could do something like that.
And especially when we're hearing a lot of more stories about situations where people try to get away with something similar. Elizabeth Holmes and Theranos. She had this black box and saying they did all these wonderful things, but would not let folks open the box. She made a series of representations and warranties to investors. Those investors relied on those reps and warranties and then handed over a check. Very similar thing. They just would not let you see what's in the black box. It's great. It's wonderful. We're going to focus on creating a narrative, a story of how wonderful and successful we are. But when someone looks or tries to look or pushes too hard, and you see some of it in the filings and the emails that Jake had with investors, oh, they're asking for too much. And to Vince's point, Jake and Irma were smart in the sense they took advantage of this desire for folks to not to lose their investment, not look bad, not look like they're not smart. And also, too, they used this kind of the urgency of now, okay, if you don't, we're going to get somebody else. You got to get in while the stock is low because we're just going up, and I'm giving you a favor by letting you give me all this money. That was pretty slick.
Let's talk about the kind of WeWork comparison. That's one that's used a lot. Obviously, there's some differences. WeWork didn't have the same philanthropic goals that Bitwise had, but how strong is that comparison in terms of a playbook?
Yeah, for me, I thought it was an extremely strong comparison. In 2018, I wrote an exam essay for my students, and I have to use false names and so they don't import real facts from cases. So I used the WeWork and I used Bitwise, I called WorkWise, to say how similar these two things were. And both WeWork and Bitwise had this culture of spending and fun and excitement and doing things and excessive executive pay, employment, nepotism, hiring, C-level positions, people that were not qualified. And at the end of the day, they were just managing properties, having gregarious CEOs that were the face of the company that were great at finding investors that wanted to put in crazy amounts of money into an investment just because of the idea of changing the world, being questioned from day one, whether they were truly a technology company. That's always been a big question with Bitwise. Let's see.
That's how they were pitched to me when I arrived in Fresno in 2018. Oh, there's this cool tech company downtown. You should go check it out. Mm-hmm. And then I went and checked it out, and I said, oh, it's like WeWork. They sell office space, right, or lease office space. And they said, no, it's not that. It's a little bit of a tech. Yeah. And I was like, well, suss that out for me. Yeah. I don't know what that means exactly.
Yeah, what's interesting, too, is that what WeWork did, and I don't know exactly, it's reflected in the complaints of when WeWork started, I'm sorry, when I'm up already, yeah. When Bitwise started selling the property. And they weren't even owners of the property. And that's what WeWork did, too. They never really owned the property. And so they pretended as if they had assets. And these assets are used in the valuation to show some type of justification for the cost of the shares for investors.
There's been a lot of controversy around the sentencing for Jake and Irma. Some people say it was too extreme. Some people say it was too light. The judge, when making the sentencing decision, actually cited the Theranos sentencing and comparable. Vince, how should we view the sentencing that they got?
What factors go into it? How do they think about it?
Federal sentencing for a white-collar case, we would call it like this, is complicated and actually does bestow quite a bit of discretion on the judge. This isn't the case with some, for instance, drug cases and some what we call violent crime cases that are more likely to have what's called a mandatory minimum where the judge can't go below a certain level. In a white collar case like this, the judge has a lot of discretion. And what typically happens is, as happened here, in the plea agreement, the parties will discuss things like the sentencing guidelines, and those are these federal guidelines that are issued that assign a point system for different kinds of conduct. And then based on those points, there's a recommended range for the court. And what kind of drives that and why the points were really high, and those are set forth in the plea agreements. What really drove the points to be really high here is the amount of loss, which was 65 million to 125 million. That was the range. That added a lot of points. Number of victims, and then there are a number of factors that kind of go into that. And the parties then agree about what they can argue as to the range. Now here, the government agreed that it would stay at the low end of the guideline range, which was 151 months for both of them in what it argued. So it couldn't argue for more than 151 months, which I think is a little over 12 years. Both of these defendants were allowed to argue down to 60 months, but they couldn't argue lower. So they couldn't argue lower than 5 years. So the court was deciding between, really, because the court is probably going to take those recommendations. They're not going to vary below. So they're deciding between 5 years and 12 and a half years. The court went closer to the government's recommendation here. They went closer to the 12, I think, for both of them than to the five. And why the court decided to do that, as in many of these cases, is anyone's guess. And this is a strange feature of the federal system where the judge that you have, the attorney you have, a lot of different factors can have a tremendous impact in the sentence you end up getting. Mm-hmm. And it's a bit strange because there is a sort of luck of the draw for defendants and for the government in terms of what judge you get and how the sentencing goes for you. And here, it's really unclear why a judge decides to go to a particular point in the guideline range or decide more with the government than the defendant. And again, the forgery of bank statements, like the blatantness of the fraud, I think played a role. And federal sentencing for white collar cases is highly discretionary, and nobody walks into that courtroom knowing how it's going
to
go.
Yeah. Can you talk about restitution? Because there's a restitution element to this case too. How does that work?
How it works in most criminal cases is that, particularly white collar cases, is that there's, particularly where there's a lot of loss, is that there's an order to pay a whole bunch of money and it never gets paid because, okay, like here.
So it's symbolic more than.
The reality is that the government will do what it can to collect the funds.
How?
But they.
Like over time, like
do
incremental
they seize
payments?
Assets or. Like,
so they can. The government has various mechanisms to collect a restitution judgment, but the reality is that unless these two individuals somehow, when they get out of jail in a while, manage to get jobs that are highly lucrative, I can't imagine how these victims are going to see much of this money at all. I know that there are certain percentages of wages that can be garnished and things like that, but I don't recall exactly what the percentages are. And yeah, it could be in perpetuity, but the reality is that just like child support, just like alimony, if the spouse isn't working or you can't squeeze blood from a turnip, and it's going to be very hard, especially when we're talking about this kind of money.
Yeah. I think they should definitely give it to my student loan service provider because they're very persistent with me. Maybe they can help us out with Jake and Irma.
You know, the amount here they were ordered to pay was over $114 million.
Yeah. I think what's interesting too, it goes back to what we were talking about before about whether this was a tech company or not. If they had assets, they had intellectual property, if they had all kinds of different major contracts that they could still perform on. And it was, I think at some point, some contracts were sold over or assumed and they weren't able to even generate any profit because they weren't really profitable contracts to begin with. It goes back to the whole, what was really under, in that black box, what was under the hood. Because if they did have something, mm-hmm. they would be able to pay back at least through those assets.
Yeah, that's why like Sam Bankman-Fried, those investors, they got their principal back. Obviously, they still had a loss because they didn't get any earnings. But like Elizabeth Holmes, that box didn't work.
Yeah, that box
and
didn't
so there's
work,
no money.
And all the folks in the FTX matter were made whole. But again, like you said, that doesn't matter. It wasn't the fact that he got lucky. It was the fact that he commingled funds and even lied. And then they could have had that money in their custody and possession to make more off of it. And they lost the interest and the earnings off of it.
Mm-hmm. Vince, do you think that should we expect to see Jake and Irma serve the full term
Typically, in there's no parole in the federal system, they say, and typically everybody ends up serving 85% because you do get 15%, I think, for what they call, good time credit or whatever, and it's just an incentive not to cause trouble in prison. But it's not the case that in 5 years they'll go before a parole board and get to say they're reformed. That doesn't happen in the federal system.
There's a lot of stereotypes about federal prison being a country club. Is there any veracity to that relative to state prisons?
I watched this TV show where Marianne Jones, the old track and field star U.S. athlete who won gold and had multiple world records, who used enhancement performing drugs, she lied to federal prosecutors and went to jail for that. And it was 6 months. And in this reality show, she talks about how demoralizing it was and how horrible it was. And this was a former track star, and then got into a little scuffle with somebody to protect herself. And because of that one little scuffle, that fight, she was in 49 days of solitary confinement.
Okay, maybe not the country club I go to.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah.
I know we've been talking about investors, but I will add there's been a settlement reached in one of the class action lawsuits filed against Bitwise. That was related to their failure to comply with the WARN Act about notifying employees in advance of the mass layoffs. One of the attorneys on that case is Roger Benakdar, and he told us around the time of the sentencing in December that as a result of that settlement and in combination with what's happening in bankruptcy court, he does expect that employees who all saw at least their final paychecks bounce will be made whole on those as a result of this settlement. And that's separate from the investors, but.
Yeah, and it's interesting. I wonder how that's gonna be funded, whether it's through company assets or insurance coverage or who knows.
I believe it was insurance.
Yeah, that's what I figured, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I want to keep going back to this accountability question, and there's been so many other cases that you both have mentioned as similar to the Bitwise tale. Why does this keep happening? Why don't we have better protections by the SEC or other federal agencies to prevent this type of fraud?
Let me add a second layer on that. I just read Nate Silver's book where he talks about Sam Bankman-Fried, and I've read bits and pieces of the biography that came out. There's still like a kind of a adoration almost. In Nate Silver's book, there's discussions about making bets, and sometimes you lose your whole pot. Does that change your calculus on making those bets? And so it seems like it's really clouded with this kind of rationalist perspective of you're just trying to do something and it doesn't always work out, but that doesn't mean the original activity is inherently bad.
Yeah, are you familiar with Michael Lewis's book?
Yeah, that's what I was referencing.
Some of the criticism he got. You're right there watching the whole thing, and I've heard him speak on several podcasts post verdict and after sentencing for Sam Bankman-Fried, and he's still the guy. And he did some. But I think when it comes to this idea of an opportunity to get rich, an opportunity to be wealthy, and there's always risk involved in any type of investment. And there's laws that require that there be disclaimers, and if you're supposed to have accurate financials and all these things are required. But it's so difficult for somebody, imagine if you're making an investment and I had an idea, and how do you see what if I'm telling you is correct and true? So there's always that risk, there's the trust element, and it's ripe for the ability for someone to easily just say whatever. And like we talked about before, there's the birth of kind of laws that deal with corporations and regulate corporations. One of the big ones was 1934, and it was prior, all these different companies were coming about and using state laws and how corporations are formed to try to build something new and fresh, and they were able to get people's money, and there was never an actual business, just scamming people all the time. So the whole law of corporations was built on this idea of a scam and a scheme and to protect folks from the beginning. And we just see it hundreds of years later, less than 100 years, huh?
Almost
90,
100.
90 years later, the same issue. It's in where people that have control of the information are able to make representations. People who are looking to invest, they know it's risky, they do it anyways. But like this situation, just the level of forgery, the level of intentional bad acting, that's just that's another level.
I think from my perspective, and this is just my personal opinion, I'll go out on a limb a little bit here, but I think that from my perspective, I've always seen one of the drivers of this kind of like criminal misconduct is it's the fact that from my perspective, the like the federal government and the federal agencies that police like criminal fraud, investment fraud like this, the reality is that there are resource constraints, these cases are extremely hard to put together, even when it's blatant like this. You would not believe the number of documents and the amount of financial analysis that goes into proving up one of these cases, even when it's perfectly obvious what happened. It takes teams of people to put this together. And as a result, it's the government can only, when it comes to these criminal cases, they can only work on so many and they can only focus on so many. And a lot of our resources for funding, particularly federal funding for criminal activity, tends to go to violent crime and drugs and things like that. And for these cases that take a lot of resources to put together, you can only take on so many. And whereas I would argue that particularly with defendants like this, these are folks that actually are very deterrable, I think, by things like, I think other potential fraudsters, I think they are deterred by seeing things like this. And I think that the more activity, the more sort of prosecution for things like this and hefty prison terms, I think it would have an appreciable impact on this kind of activity, because these are the kind of folks that really don't want to go to jail. Nobody does. These are the folks that would be particularly scared to go to jail, these white collar criminals.
It will be very destructive to their lives, yes.
Yeah. And so I think resource constraints play a huge role in it. I also think that something else, when you have people, and I think it's fair to say from reading this complaint, and I don't know, but it certainly looks from this complaint like there were folks at the company that had a good sense of what was going on that weren't these two individuals. Now, it doesn't indicate that they were complicit in the fraud or that they acted, but you might ask, like, why didn't they go to the FBI, or why didn't they do something, or why didn't they? And I think the answer is that just like any of us, it's really hard to tell somebody that has a family and that depends on their job and their paycheck. It's really hard to tell them that they should risk it and go to a federal agency. And so as a result, I think that these kind of situations, there are a lot of people that might know what's going on, but just don't come forward. And I can't really fault them for it.
In reading through the criminal complaint and the court documents, is it pretty clear that there were some informants on the inside?
I don't know about informants. I know that the complaint indicates that certainly there were people inside the company that raised concerns, and the government definitely interviewed people,
right,
from reading this complaint that worked at the company. I'm not sure if there were any quote-unquote informants.
Because that's been a question I've heard from a lot of people just out and about, has been why just Jake and Irma, it seems, to maintain the mirage that was Bitwise and everything that happened, that there would be a lot more
help.
People in
the
C-suite that would have been involved in that process.
Yeah, I think that all I can say in terms of helping them, all I can say is that for this criminal case, what mattered most for the charges that were brought was who made the representations to the investors. And that was only two people. I'm not sure about people helping them or anything like that. It definitely seemed like they were the face of the company.
Yeah, and it seemed like let's say for instance you have staff accountants that felt like the practices that we're engaging in are not at the standard that we should be doing. And there's talk of that, right? Mm-hmm. And there's mention of gap principles, where it's an accepted way to do accounting. And you start making, what they would do is they would make these representations that we do our accounting and we follow these principles so you can trust our reports. But there were folks inside that knew, no, we're not, and I don't feel comfortable with us making those type of statements on these financial statements or on this slide deck for the board members. So there was that kind of knowledge, which is very different from now what did they use those documents for when they're telling and pledging different shares and trying to get investors to fork over the money.
Yeah. But I think what you said, Vince, really rings true, I would imagine, for a lot of people who worked there, where if you got a job at Bitwise during the heyday, you were probably drawing comfortable six figures, mm-hmm, jumping from a profession that would have paid you maybe half of that. Why would you give up a life-changing salary?
We always end this podcast with what we're loving this week. Jesse, what are you loving this week?
Spending some time with my 16-year-old daughter, who is in that teenager mode, and so doesn't like to spend time with me that much, so I'll take whatever I can get.
Vince, what about you?
I don't know. I got a bread maker.
Tell us more. Yeah, I want to hear about your bread maker.
This is the right crowd.
Yes, absolutely. Yeah, lay it on.
It was the one recommended by Wirecutter. It was like this Japanese Zojirushi, or I forget who makes it, but it was their recommendation. You just put the ingredients in and it mixes it up and it just bakes it. It rises and it bakes it. You don't have to do anything.
How's it taste? Does it taste good?
It's good. It's bread.
Are we talking about for like sandwiches, like a bread roll like that?
Yeah, it just makes a loaf of bread.
Oh, yeah. Fantastic.
So that I like that.
I've never tried one. Have you tried one, Donnie? A bread maker?
No, I have not.
What are you? Yeah, maybe. What are you loving this week?
What am I loving this week? Oh, playing pickleball with my son.
Oh.
Yeah, I'm a little bit late to the trend, but super into it now.
Yeah, it's fun. You don't have to. It's not like tennis where you're chasing balls everywhere. It's like pretty contained.
I love tennis, though. I played tennis in high school. I was not a very good tennis player, but I like to play tennis. And I was a little snobby about pickleball. This is like the
But you get it now.
I do get it. And it's more kid-friendly. So I like it for that reason.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
Juliana, what are you loving this week?
I loved some of the surprises in the Oscar nominations. I was happy to see The Substance.
Yes. Do you think Demi's going to win?
I think she has a good chance.
Yeah, I think so. It's between her and I don't really know who else.
Maybe Fernanda Torres.
Oh, yeah, I'm still here. Yeah, for sure.
Which I haven't seen yet, but I hope it comes to Fresno.
Yeah. Have you guys seen The Substance?
No, I've heard it's on my list. Though.
Yeah, I watched it recently after Juliana's recommendation, and I loved everything until about the last 40 minutes when we get into some serious body horror. And then I was eating popcorn while I was watching, and that was not something I'd recommend. And speaking of gross things, what I'm loving this week is I'm going back and watching 28 Days Later and 28 Weeks Later, because there's a new 28 Years Later that's coming out this spring. It's, I don't know, 2007, I think, is when 28 Weeks Later came out. So we're coming on almost 20 years since it. And the trailer's incredible. I love zombie movies. And 28 Days Later actually holds up. It feels very early 2000s, like in the cinematography, but I loved rewatching it. Have you seen 28 Days Later? Do you like zombie movies?
I hate zombie movies. Except, actually, I take that back. I love the Netflix movie Mitchells versus the Machines, which is not a zombie movie, but it's a robots taking over the world movie.
Okay,
so I think
that's a different category. I'm going to draw some lines
here. Yeah. I don't like anything scary.
What about you guys? Zombie movies? Is that up your alley?
I like 28 Days Later and 28 Weeks Later.
Not a big zombie movie watcher at all. And I don't know if this one qualifies, though, but the one I did like, the series, The Last of Us.
Oh, yes. Incredible.
And the second season's coming up real soon.
I can't wait.
I'm going to watch that one for sure.
Yes, the video game was incredible. The show was incredible. All great stuff.
Is that considered a zombie movie?
Yeah, it's a zombie TV show. Okay, yeah, a zombie series. Okay. Yeah,
that's the only one I've ever liked or watched.
This has been Fresnolandia. I'm Jordan Maddox.
I'm Donnie Bergstrom. And this podcast was recorded at Sun Stereo Warehouse in downtown Fresno. Audio editing and mixing was done by Jordan Maddox. Our lead image comes from Vaughn Ballinan. And our song comes from Stateless Rat.